Fáil chugadh your Irish connection with Laura O'Brien, providing your authentic connection to Ireland with a native voice on a mix of Irish mythology, Indigenous spirituality, archaeology, history, culture, society, storytelling, and travel around the island. Get more on www.lauraobrien.ie. That's LauraOBrien.ie. War in Celtic society. In order to evaluate the war goddess model, it is first necessary to define war in its specific context. Different societies wage war in different ways. The gods of war must reflect the native concept of war, not a general or foreign understanding of it. Thus, if the Morrigan is a war goddess, she should reflect the Irish practice of war. And if we can be justified in calling her a Celtic war goddess, the Celtic practice. The main form of war among the medieval Irish was the cattle raid, which was in spirit more comparable to one urban gang riding on another than to our modern conception of war. In the literature, the story of a cattle raid was called a tawn. While McCanna emphasizes the archaism of this act, citing comparative Indo-European evidence, he also brings up its social utility. Quote, "The successful cattle raid was an assertion of the integrity of the tribal community vis-a-vis its neighbours and a vindication of its leader's claim to primacy over his people." End quote. He further notes that, quote, "The same route, a.g., to drive or pursue, from which the Irish tawn or cattle raid is derived, gives also aor, meaning battle slaughter, and has been taken as the source of, a.g., battle, valour." And this lexical nexus points up the importance of cattle raiding in the heroic ideology of the Celtic warrior class. End quote. Francis Byrne is more specific in his explanation of the social importance of the tawn, given its immediate Irish context. In medieval Ireland, tribute was reckoned in cattle, and as a result, wars tended to be cattle raids, a representation on a large scale of the legal process of ócáil, the distraint of a debtor's chattels. Distraint was one of the chief mechanisms for the settlement of claims and the working out of grievances. The defendant's chattels were impounded by the person pressing the suit to force the defendant to submit to arbitration. If he refused, his chattels were forfeit. The cattle raid may also have been used as a means of forcing tribute and or otherwise bringing followers to heel. But perhaps most importantly of all, success on a raid was the principal means of gaining prestige. While the storytelling genre is known as the tawn, the social institution is known as craic, which originally meant marking, cauterizing, branding, but which came to mean either the foray itself or the cattle which were the booty of the raid. A survey of legal texts shows what a commonplace occurrence these raids were. Indeed, as A.T. Lucas notes, quote, "It would be futile to attempt to assess the importance of the role played by cattle in Ireland without devoting considerable attention to cattle raiding. Nothing in Irish society is better documented over so long a period. It is the most typical and abiding event recorded in the annals down the centuries, and it pervades almost every branch of Irish literature. Indeed, a review of the numerous references to raids makes it plain that any kind of military action, arising from whatever cause and prosecuted for whatever end, almost certainly involved an attempt by the aggressor to secure a prey of cows from the party attacked, whether as a primary or a secondary objective." End quote. In some cases, the craic was planned as retaliation for a previous raid, for the death of someone during a previous rage, raid even, although rage may have been included. that bit wasn't in the text. For the death of someone in a ruling family, or for slights to personal dignity. However, personal gain of cattle and prestige was generally enough motivation. Another practice which sounds suspiciously like a specialised incarnation of the cattle raid is the Crec Rí, literally a king's raid. A raid led by a newly elected king on the herds of traditional enemies of his people in order to celebrate his inauguration, demonstrate his suitability for office, and gain him a heroic reputation, as well as the cattle necessary to being a generous host. According to Pádraig Ó Rian, there is evidence for this practice from 1083 to 1600 CE Common Era. Lucas notes possible records of inaugurations raids from 628 Common Era on. According to Lucas, this ritual raid by the new king may have been only a specialised extension of an initiation ceremony involving all the young males of the tribe. He cites the following passage from the Middle Irish Cor Anman, The Fitness of Names. The translation is, "This was the custom of the Ulstermen. Each young man of theirs who first took up arms would enter the province of Connacht on a foray for Crick, or to seek to slay a human being." End quote. Martin Martin's account of the ancient and modern customs of the inhabitants of the Western Isles of Scotland shows a practice of this type lasting even later than either Lucas or Ó Rian claim. Writing in 1695, he tells of a practice only 60 years in the past. Quote, "Every heir or young chieftain of a tribe was obliged to give a public specimen of his valour before he was owned and declared governor or leader of his people, who obeyed and followed him upon all occasions. This chieftain was usually attended by a retinue of young men of quality who had not beforehand given any proof of their valour and were ambitious of such an opportunity to signalise themselves. It was usual for the captain to lead them, to make a desperate incursion upon some neighbour or other that they were in feud with, and they were obliged to bring by open force the cattle they found in the lands they attacked, or to die in the attempt. After the performance of this achievement, the young chieftain was ever after reputed valiant and worthy of government, and such as were of his retinue acquired like reputation." End quote. Martin's account is strikingly reminiscent of the Ulster cycle tales, as we shall see. Another element of war in medieval Ireland, and as related to us by classical authors among the continental Celts, was the use of both noise and poetic performance in armed conflict. On a campaign in Galla Graecia, the consul Gnaeus Manlius informs his men about the Gauls. Quote, "Tall bodies, long reddish hair, huge shield, very long swords. In addition, songs as they go into battle and yells and leapings and the dreadful din of arms as they clash shields according to some ancestral custom. All these are deliberately used to terrify their foes." End quote. The consul's words to his forces are echoed throughout classical writing on the Celtic peoples. The most often attested sounds are the battle cry, songs, and a general din. Polybius adds trumpets as well. Quote, "The Romans were terrified by the fine order of the Celtic host and the dreadful din, for there were innumerable horn blowers and trumpeters, and, as the whole army were shouting their war cries at the same time, there was such a tumult of sound that it seemed that not only the trumpets and the soldiers, but all the country round had got a voice and caught up the cry." End quote. This practice was effective. The Romans were known to run away simply in terror at the unfamiliar din. On one occasion, Livy tells us that the Romans ran before they even saw the Gauls. Single combat called for parallel practices. We read of Gauls and Celt-Iberians who, immediately before or during single combat, sing praises of their families and themselves, and revile their opponents. Silius Italicus tells us that one Crixus sent forth a cry and roused his own fury with hideous yells. Nor was the war cry limited to terrifying the enemy or rousing martial passions. Noise and song were also used to celebrate victory. After defeating an enemy in single combat, the Celt Iberians and the Gauls would raise the severed head and whoop or sing. On at least two occasions, Livy tells us that as part of their oral barrage, the Gauls would clash their shields. Other classical sources may offer confirmation of this ancestral custom, although it is difficult to be certain which northern barbarians they are treating. Classical authors often lumped Celtic and Germanic peoples together. The term Germani, originally a Celtic tribal name, was used to designate any intruders coming into Gaul from across the Rhine. In his Germania, Tacitus says, regarding such transrhenine groups, quote, "They have also those cries by the utterance of which Baritus is the name they use. They inspire courage, and they divine the fortunes of the coming battle from the circumstance of the cry. Intimidation or timidity depends on the concert of the warriors. It seems to them to mean not so much unison of voices as unison of hearts. The object they specially seek is a certain volume of hoarseness, a crashing roar, their shields being brought up to their lips, that the voice may swell to a fuller and deeper note by means of the echo." End quote. The Baritus sounds remarkably like what Gnaeus Manlius was warning his troops about. There are similar accounts among Celtic peoples in much more recent times. Not all pre-battle hullabaloo was intended to make the enemy ineffective. A more pleasant-sounding practice is apparent in both continental Celtic practice and in later Gaelic tradition: the composition of poems by the warrior or by a bard, designed to encourage warriors in battle. The continental Celtic evidence comes from Diodorus Siculus, who writes, quote, "When any man accepts the challenge to battle, they then break forth into a song of praise of the valiant deeds of their ancestors and in boast of their own high achievements." End quote. That these songs were also performed by professional class of poets is not made explicit here, but it is clear in later accounts of incitement to battle. The poetic incitement to battle is a genre well attested in Scottish Gaelic. One example of this genre is the Harla Brosnacha, said to have been composed before the Battle of Harla in 1411 and preserved in two manuscripts from the second half of the 18th century. On linguistic grounds, Derek Thompson finds a 15th century date credible. In both manuscript copies, and in all early printed reference, the poem is called a Brosnacha Cata, an incitement to battle. The close agreement of all these sources argues that this was a generic label, as does the existence of other poems with the same designation. Thompson notes the similarity between the techniques and vocabulary used in this poem and those in the Rosc Gwyll from the Book of the Dean of Lismore. This is a Scottish version of the Irish poetic form known as the Rusca. As we shall see, not only do Ruscada appear in numerous martial contexts, embedded in the medieval Irish prose tales, but the Morrigan is also credited with a number of poems of this type. Martin Martin outlines the context in which such a composition would have been performed. Quote, "Before they engaged the enemy in battle, the chief druid harangued the enemy, the army, to excite their courage. He was placed on an eminence, from whence he addressed himself to all of them standing about him, putting them in mind of what great things were performed by the valour of their ancestors, raised their hopes with the noble rewards of honour and victory, and dispelled their fears by all the topics that natural courage could suggest. After this harangue, the army gave a general shout and then charged the enemy stoutly. This in the ancient language was called brosnikika, i.e. an incentive to war. Thus poetry and noise were mixed together at the onset of battle. The harla brosnika is traditionally viewed as having been intended to raise the spirits of Donald of Harlaw's host. This Scottish tradition of performing poems to encourage soldiers in battle corresponds to a medieval Irish tradition which we will see below in a number of texts. Another aspect of Celtic warfare has been made much of. According to many sources, the women fought beside the men. The Greek historian Polybius wrote in the 2nd century BCE, before Common Era, that in time of war, Celtic women accompanied their husbands into battle, following them in wagons. Not only can we establish the presence of Celtic women on the battlefield from the accounts of classical writers, but we also read of women in combat. In some cases, the women in the wagons joined the fight. A description of the Celtic woman warrior, embedded in an exposition of the manners and customs of the Gauls, comes from the Roman history of Ammianus Marcellinus, a 4th century writer in Byzantium, who derived much of his material from Timagene, a contemporary of the Emperor Augustus. Quote, "In fact, a whole band of foreigners will be unable to cope with one of them in a fight. If he call in his wife, stronger than he by far and with flashing eyes, least of all when she swells her neck and gnashes her teeth, and poising her white arms, proceeds to rain punches mingled with kicks, like shots discharged by the twisted cords of a catapult." End quote. Not only is there evidence that the women of the continental Celts were seen in battle, but there's also evidence that British and Irish women were involved in battle, both as war leaders and as combatants. Of course, Maeve, warrior queen of the Irish prose narrative tradition, comes to mind at once, but there is also evidence of a historical nature. Both Tacitus and Dio Cassius, 150 to 235 Common Era, tell the well-known story of Boudica, widow of Prasutagus, king of the Iceni, a tribe of Britons located in East Anglia. Prasutagus died in 59 Common Era, willing the emperor Nero co-heir with his two daughters. However, the Roman procurator seized the entire area for the emperor, and Boudica was flogged by the Romans while her daughters were raped. In 61 Common Era, she launched a revolt against the Romans, joined by other tribes. The British forces included women. Three Roman cities, Colchester, London, and St. Albans, fell to Boudica's fury, with 70,000 of their inhabitants butchered. Despite Boudica's encouragement before the battle, an incitement perhaps in the manner of the later Brosnika Kaha, the Britons were eventually routed and massacred in a battle near Towcester. The early modern period features numerous Irish and Scottish female war leaders. One, Dervorgal, led the men of Clan Murta against the churches of Drumcliffe during the Bruce War of the 14th century. Agnes Campbell, Lady Cantyre, with 2,000 of her own men, accompanied her husband in the siege of the castle of Dunluce in 1584. Her daughter went to Ireland after marrying Hugh O'Donnell of Donegal, and in 1590 led troops against her husband's son by his first wife. There is evidence that insular Celtic women not only led in battle but fought as well. In Tacitus' account of the Roman assault on the island of Anglesey in 61 Common Era, women and druids are prominently featured among the British warriors drawn up to protect the island's sacred groves from the Roman forces. Tacitus describes the women thus, quote, "In the style of furies, in robes of deathly black and with dishevelled hair, they brandished their torches. This comparison of warlike Celtic women with the Furies may, as we shall see in a later chapter, carry far more meaning than a convenient metaphor. There are accounts of women in battle in Ireland up to 1592, and in Wales as well as late as 1797. Not all of these engagements were desperate attempts at defence. John Bellenden's 1531 translation of the Chronicles of Scotland by Hector Bos features voluminous testimony to the fierceness of Scottish women. Two will suffice. The women visit to pass in set battle and fought more cruelly than any men, having no mercy, quare a war victorious. Quen women of... Okay, this bit is in theoretical English, in very old style of English. So I can't actually read it. Apologies for that. But there are two quotes that attest to the fierceness of Scottish women. End quotes. According to the Irish law tracts, daughters who inherited land from their mothers in the absence of male heirs were liable for military service. According to Irish tradition, this obligation was abolished by Adam Nan, whose law was the first made for women in heaven and on earth. In the prose tale prefacing Con Adamnan, the law of Adamnan, the saint's mother, Ronnet, shows her son the pitifulness of dead women on the battlefield, and she tortures him physically until he agrees to free women from the battlefield and slavery. This tale is not to be taken as history, and it cannot be asserted that Irish women went into battle at the time of Saint Adamnan. It is clear, at any rate, that the medieval Irish believed that their female forebears fought beside their forefathers. However, this tradition of Celtic women fighting in battle raises as many questions about the Morrigan as it answers. For the most part, as we shall see, the Morrigan does not take direct action in battle. Yet she is inextricably bound up with the use of noise and poetic performance as weapons of war, and she is often involved in conflict over the ownership of cattle. The reader should therefore keep in mind the nature of Celtic, and particularly Irish, war, as we examine the appearances of the Morrigan and her counterparts in Irish, Celtic, and other Indo-European literature and lore. That was a reading from War Goddess, a dissertation by Angelique Golomovich Epstein. This was an imperfect reading for accessibility purposes from War Goddess, the Morrigan and her Germano-Celtic counterparts, a dissertation by Angelique Golomovich Epstein, read by me, Laura O'Brien, and you can find more like this at www.lauraobrien.ie. Sláinte.